This public radio podcast is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org, and by KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM.
Did you bring your milk money?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. The price of milk is now about the same as the price of gas, almost $4 a gallon. There may be a lot of reasons milk prices have gone up so much, but one of them could be that dairy farmers are manipulating the price. The Wall Street Journal says the government is about to bring charges of price fixing. Dan Gretsch has more.
Over the past 4 years, consumer milk prices have risen about 32%. That's more than double the rate of increase for food prices in general. The Department of Agriculture alleges the dairy farmers of America drove down what it paid for raw milk by misreporting prices to the USDA. And the dairy co-op allegedly drove up the price retailers paid for the milk through trading at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Henry Kanukin is an agricultural economist at Auburn University. He found in a study that while milk price increases are passed on to consumers, milk price drops are pocketed by middlemen like the dairy farmers of America.
When farm prices go down, the retail prices tend to be sticky, which means that the margins are widened. And that's a fairly classic symptom of market power being exercised by middlemen.
Revenue for the dairy farmers of America grew to $11.1 billion in 2007, up nearly 50% from the year before. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Wall Street is off to a ho-hum start for the week. In early trading, the Dow is up 16 points to 13,003. The NASDAQ has gained 6. The S&P 500 is up 2 points. In Europe, stocks are up about 1% near the close. Stocks in Asia added a fraction today. In China, the stock market stopped trading for 3 minutes. And all over the country, car horns blared. It marked the beginning of 3 days of mourning for the victims of last week's earthquake. The death toll could reach 50,000. Reporter Jamila Trindle joins us now from the earthquake zone. Jamila, what's happening with the people who survived?
Well, there are a couple official shelters that have been set up in stadiums and schools, and they're being given food, and people have set up places where they can make free phone calls. But in addition to that, just driving around, you see all these tents set up everywhere. So there's a lot of different ways that people are coping for now, but it's unclear what the next step will be for them.
And what about the aid that is coming in from the government, and I also understand from the people of China?
There's been a large outpouring of aid, and volunteers have been arriving, sometimes too many and too disorganized. But there's been a lot of aid from different companies. The government, they're offering about $1.40 a day for people that have been affected and displaced by the quake. And so they're really hoping that people will cycle through these camps of 15 to 30,000 people.
China kind of stood still today with the moment of silence, and the stock market had a moment of silence, and a lot of things were closed. But there's going to be a process here of people getting back on their feet financially. Do we know anything about the plans for that happening?
Individuals seem to have little plan as to what to do next. Even the buildings that are still standing and look to be okay, workers are hesitant to go back into them. And of course, we've heard a lot in the past week about how substandard the school buildings were.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people are hoping the government will come in with some sort of effort to rebuild. But individuals have little means to rebuild themselves. A lot of people have lost absolutely everything. As far as where they're going to go from there, it's still unknown.
Jamila Trindle in China's Sichuan province, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
This is the Morning Report for Monday, May 19th on Marketplace.org. The internet has changed the way we do so many things, But when it comes to shopping, a new survey finds the internet may not be all it's cracked up to be. Ashley Milne-Tite has more.
Some people can barely remember research before the internet. The Pew Internet Project looked at how people use the web to shop for music, a cell phone and a home, and how much all that clicking affects their eventual decision. John Horrigan is an associate director with the project.
We found that on the order of 10% of people in each category said that the internet had a major impact on their final purchase decision. And that was surprising for a good like music, where there's just a wealth of music information online and the chance to sample.
Horrigan says even most respondents in the Facebook generation said they find out about music through radio or TV or offline friends. He says people still crave the human touch in the form of in-store sales advice, for example. As for feedback posted by consumers, a third of us use those comments to help us make a decision, but only about 6% of us bother to post our own critiques. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
A popular website is getting a makeover today. Time Incorporated is relaunching health.com. The idea is to make it less of an online magazine and more of an extensive medical database. Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
On sites like WebMD, AOL Body, and Everyday Health, you can describe your symptoms and read a terrifying roster of things your headache might mean. But the information offerings are about to explode, says James Unland, editor of the Journal of Healthcare Finance.
Consumers will be able to compare hospitals by medical mistakes and infection rates. They'll be able to compare doctors. We are in the beginnings of a major consumer gateway here that is going to be like the equivalent of 100 libraries of Congress.
Health.com has a lot of catching up to do. Industry leader WebMD gets around 20 million visitors a month, and those are some very valuable eyeballs, says advertising executive Adam Hampft.
When you're on WebMD and you're searching in Alzheimer's disease or diabetes, when you target that person with a message from a drug company, you've got the perfect combination of need and product.
And many of those customers are well-heeled baby boomers. Hampft says drug companies are one surefire client, but so are travel companies and retailers. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Working from home may sound like the greatest thing in the world, but for many people, it can be isolating. There's a new alternative. It's called co-working. Here's Alex Goldmark.
Political consultant Joanne Wright used to work from home, but it got lonely.
Great apartment, great cat, but I kind of lost my mind after trying to work there for 6 months.
So after trying out noisy coffee shops, she found Newtopia, a co-working space in Lower Manhattan. Co-working is an emerging practice of sharing a workspace, but not the work. This large, sunny office with over 40 desks is designed to encourage interaction. There aren't any cubicles and hardly any walls.
I like to take in the fact that he's over there organizing Broadway auditions that has nothing to do with what I'm working on. She's putting together ad campaigns. People are just from all different walks of life.
Well, not exactly all walks of life. It's mostly tech workers and creative types and a few non-profiters, too.
Exactly. Everything's going to work with our existing customer base.
At 2 p.m. on a Friday, this Midtown apartment is calm but crowded. 15 or so laptop-lugging young professionals are sitting thigh-to-thigh on couches, futons, and even the floor. It's a bi-weekly work-together day called JELLY, which doesn't stand for anything, by the way. 2 years ago, founder Amit Gupta used to work from home with his roommates, but they still craved company.
So we just started, at some point, inviting over like one or two people to work on the kitchen table with us, just because we thought it'd be fun. And they told their friends, and other people told each other, and
and now it's a public event replicated in 18 cities. Jeremy Mims is a regular attendee. He says for most people here, the lore is social.
They sit around doing work sometimes, but mostly it's a good place to just interact and find out what other people are working on.
So you're not more productive when you're here, are you?
I'm not more productive, but I'm a lot happier.
And he's better connected, which is crucial according to Sarah Horowitz, head of the 70,000-member Freelancers Union.
It's not just about socializing. It's not just about hanging out. That is exactly the way that people find out where work is. So if they're not getting out of their homes, they will be truly unsuccessful.
Trying to balance productivity with my freelancer's urge to socialize, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
To see what that jelly workday looks like, find the video at marketplace.org. Yahoo and Microsoft are back to flirting. They're not talking about a full-blown marriage this time, just a casual partnership in online searches and advertising. The buyout is off the table for the moment, to the dismay of many Yahoo shareholders, but not all.
And now it's time for the Sloan Sessions.
Alan, you say in deals like this, shareholders usually fall into two camps. What do you mean by that?
Well, when some offer has surfaced, many of the big shareholders of the company, that's what we call in the trade the target, have to decide whether they want to hold the stock to see if the deal goes through or whether they want to sell it in the market and let someone else, known in the trade as a risk arbitrageur, take the risk.
But in this case, the deal fell through. So what happened?
The stock had been 19 before Microsoft appeared, so a lot of players took their 50% windfall, you know, from 19 to 28, and had given the risk to the buyers, and they really got whacked when Microsoft originally called off the deal. The price of Yahoo stock fell rather sharply. Then they complained publicly about Yahoo, which I thought was really sort of childish, because they could have sold their stock.
Well, Alan, are you a patient type investor, or are you an arbitrageur?
These days, I'm patient with a little soupçon of arb, because, again, I happen to own Wrigley stock, and Wrigley, I've owned it for years and years and years. And as you may or may not know, Wrigley was dragging along in the 60s, and an offer came for 80 from the Mars family and Warren Buffett. And the stock shot up. You know, it's very, very high in the, right, in the high 70s. So I have a question of whether or not to sell into the market in the 70s or to wait for my 80. And I've pretty much chosen to wait for my 80 because I think it's, you know, a reasonably certain thing to happen. Now, if it turns out the deal breaks up and the stock goes back to 60, you'll hear me sobbing, but you won't hear me whining.
All right, Alan Sloan from Fortune Magazine, thank you.
You're welcome.
Feel free to share your thoughts with us online at marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.